we started a little bit last week, the series called Lyric, that we're going to do from now until we start Lent. And mostly, I'm just really excited. We're going to do a lot of fun things. So I think I've plugged in three different song lyrics that we're going to talk about over the next couple months. I talked to Erin this morning, and her and I are going to exegete a poem together. I'm thinking some Mary Oliver, probably, because we both really like Mary Oliver. And then Eric Potter gave me a song to work on, so I might rope him into doing something with that. And if you have a song lyric that has changed your life, then maybe you want to suggest it to me, and I might rope you in to helping me teach about it. Did that deter everyone? Nope. So let's start here. Just for fun, I'm just curious. I've seen stuff like this online. Best song or album of 2016, go. What? Bye? Oh, yeah, you're a Radiohead guy. Is there any chance that that wasn't going to be your best album before you heard it? Okay. Okay. Okay, good. Boys to Men. Say yours, Peggy. Okay, which is better, Hamilton or the Hamilton mixtape? Thanks. This is your place, yes. A lot of ham nerds here. All right, anything else? Thrice. Wow, that feels like a throwback. Any others? Bonnie Bear? Yeah. Do you remember when he was on Saturday Night Live? I think it was back in January, and people thought his name was Bonnie Bear. What's that? Okay. Any others? It's just fun. Like, you all are an eclectic bunch. So, and I think when we start talking about lyrics, here's the thing. Some of you just like music for the tunes, but I also know that there's some of you that it's all about lyric. And I think I said this last week. It's hard to remember what I said last week because I was really tired. But I said last week, like, part of the thing about lyrics, music lyrics especially, is if you go back a couple generations, poetry was much bigger back then than it is now. And I think that we don't read as much poetry as our ancestors did. But we listen to music, and so the poets of today often are the ones writing the songs. And so that's what we're going to kind of do, is we're going to live in that space of music and poetry and even a movie line, if there's a movie line that, oh, there's a couple movie lines I'd love to do. So I've had this series in my head for a while now, so we're going to just launch out on it. Let's see. Where do we want to start? Here's the other thing we're going to do. So we're going to play with lyrics, and then for fun, I don't know why this doesn't actually connect to that, but I'm going to make it connect, is I decided that for the next couple months also, as part of the lyric thing, I'm just going to live in the Hebrew Scriptures, and I'm going to try to find stories and ideas and Psalms and Proverbs and kind of live in that space just for fun, and then we'll do Lent, and then we'll come back and we'll finish John. I started John 2 years ago today. And we're going to finish it this spring / summer, I think. So when we get to the Hebrew Scriptures, we gave our kids Bibles for Christmas, the two oldest ones. We gave them a copy of Message, and Gavin has been plowing his way through Genesis. And there's part of it that I'm like, oh, I love that he's reading Genesis, and we haven't made him. Like, we don't, like, surprising, pastor doesn't require his kids to read X number of pages of the Bible every day. But he started reading it on his own, so he and I are talking about things. There's a little part of me that's like, oh, I don't know how I feel about my kids reading the Hebrew Scriptures, right? Like, I don't know that some of these people in the Hebrew Scriptures are actually, like, you know, role models. I mean, like, think of, like, the person, like, when we think about King David, he's a man after God's own heart, but really, don't copy King David on almost everything in the Scriptures. His Psalms are really nice, but the rest of the way he lived, don't do any of that stuff. Like, all the Bible characters, I think without exception, almost every Bible character, except perhaps Enoch, in the Hebrew Scriptures, they're not to be emulated. And so it makes us sometimes, like, a little nervous about, like, what do we do with these? And I know some of you, I've had these conversations, like, how do we even teach our kids the Bible stories? Like, people love to decorate their nurseries and, like, the Noah's Ark theme, right? And maybe some of you have done this. But what about when your kids, like, put it all together, like, cute animals, mass destruction of the planet, right? Like, what happened? Like, what do we do with that? And so there's a book that I ordered this week. So it leads us to this question of what do we do with the unethical stuff we find in the Bible? And the answer that I want to read to you this morning a little bit, because I just loved it this week, comes from this guy. His name's Rowan Williams. He's the Archbishop of Canterbury. But let's start by appreciating his eyebrows. I've decided that when I get to be that age, that's going to be the look. I have it. If I just let it go a little bit longer, I can get there. I'm sure Jennifer will love it. I mean, come on. Every time I've looked at this, I've had to laugh again. All right, can I go on? All right. So he answers the question this way. I love this, and then we're going to talk about it briefly. The Bible is, you might say, God telling us a parable or a whole sequence of parables. God is saying, this is how people heard me, saw me, responded to me. This is the gift I gave them. This is the response they made. Where are you in this? If in that story we find accounts of the responses of Israel to God that are shocking or hard to accept, we do not have to work on the assumption that God likes those responses. For example, many of the early Israelites in the Old Testament clearly thought it was God's will that they should engage in ethnic cleansing, that they should slaughter without mercy the inhabitants of the Promised Land into which they had been led. And for centuries, millennia even, people have asked, does that mean God orders or approves of genocide? If he did, that would be so hideously at odds with what the biblical story as a whole seems to say about God. But if we understand that response as simply part of the story, we see that this is how people thought they were carrying out God's will at that time. The point is to look at God, look at yourself, and to ask where you are in the story. Are you capable, in the light of the Bible as a whole, of responding more lovingly or faithfully than ancient Israel? Now, somebody unpack that for me. What did you hear? How did you? That's a lot. That was a lot of slides. What's he saying? Sure. Yeah. They were trying their very best to relate to God. How are you doing that? What else? How does he suggesting we should then respond as we read the Hebrew Scriptures, and we're going to read a story here in a minute. What's the stance we're supposed to have towards these stories? Look at the bigger picture. Our understanding of God changes and grows, as does theirs. Good. Yeah, there's a part of me that would hate for somebody to take the things I taught. Jennifer and I were, I'm going to talk about this a little bit later. We were getting together with two students of ours, and they'll always be my kids, even though I pointed out to them they are closer to us in age than they are to my kids in age. It gave me great joy to make them feel old like that. And we were talking about, I think Jennifer said at one point to them, like, we're sorry for what we taught you when we were in our 20, when I was 24, 25. Like, oh my gosh, I hope I didn't screw you up too much, right? Good. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a culture these things are written in. Here's what I want to say, and then we're going to read the story, is I think that faithful exegesis then means we make moral/ethical judgments about the stories and characters we find in the Bible. It's okay to read the stories in the Hebrew Scriptures and say, boy, that was a really wrong way of understanding God. When they thought, go wipe them all out, they thought God was saying that. It's okay for us to say, well, in the light of Jesus, we know that was not the right way, but that was part of their growth and development. So that's going to be part of our strategy as we engage in Bible stories, particularly with human beings relating to God. Sometimes we're going to have to stand back and go, no, we shouldn't do it that way. Turn to Judges chapter 6. And we're going to practice this very thing. We're going to read a story, and then we're going to ask ourselves, like, is this the way we ought to relate to God? So if you're not familiar with the literature of Judges is this series of cycles, and you're going to see it all right here. This is a great story, and we're going to read quite a bit of text, so just follow along, and I may stop along the way, but here we go. Yet again, the people of Israel went back to doing evil in God's sight. God put them under the domination of Midian for 7 years. Midian overpowered Israel. Because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves hideouts in the mountains, caves and forts. When Israel planted its crops, Midian and Amalek, the Easterners, would invade them, camp in their fields, and destroy their crops all the way down to Gaza. They left nothing for them to live on, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. Bringing their cattle in tents, they came in and took over like an invasion of locusts. And their camels, past counting, they marched in and devastated the country. The people of Israel, reduced to grinding poverty by Midian, cried out to God for help. I should have read that in movie voice, right? That would have been perfect. Like, that's a great setup in a world. One time, when the people of Israel had cried out to God because of Midian, God sent them a prophet with this message. God, the God of Israel, says, I delivered you from Egypt. I freed you from a life of slavery. I rescued you from Egypt's brutality and then from every oppressor. I pushed them out of your way and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am God, your God. Don't for a minute be afraid of the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But you didn't listen to me. One day, the angel of God came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, whose son Gideon was threshing wheat in the winepress out of sight of the Midianites. So understand, he's doing the threshing thing, but he's doing it like he's hiding while he does it. So he's having to like sneak the threshing of the grain. The angel of God appeared to him and said, God is with you, O mighty warrior. And Gideon replied, and some people think he may have been in his teens at this point, so mighty warrior. Gideon replied, with me, my master? If God was with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all the miracle wonders our parents and grandparents told us about, telling us, didn't God deliver us from Egypt? The fact is, God has nothing to do with us. He has turned us over to Midian. But God faced him directly. Go in this strength that is yours. Save Israel from Midian. Haven't I just sent you? So this angel, the way the story is being told is this angel of God that sat down under the oak tree is somehow God. And some people then go back and say, well, this is really Jesus appearing in human form. It's a pre-thing of Jesus, whatever. So verse 16, go, believe me, you'll defeat Gideon as one man. This is the part I want to get to. Gideon said, if you're serious about this, do me a favor. Give me a sign to back up what you're telling me. Don't leave until I come back and bring you my gift. He said, I'll wait until you get back. Gideon went and prepared a young goat and a huge amount of unraised bread. He used over half a bushel of flour. I like the exclamation points in the message, by the way. I don't think you get those in the NIV, but you get them here. He put the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot and took them back under the shade of the oak tree for a sacred meal. The angel of God said to him, take the meat and unraised bread, place them on that rock and pour the broth on them. And Gideon did it. And the angel of God stretched out the tip of the stick he was holding and touched the meat and the bread. Fire broke out of the rock and burned up the meat and bread while the angel of God slipped away out of sight, and Gideon knew it was the angel of God. And Gideon said, oh no, master, God, I've seen the angel of God face to face. But God reassured him, easy now, don't panic, you won't die. Then Gideon built, and I say that so casually. Then Gideon built an altar there to God and named it God's Peace. It's still called that at Ophrah of Abiezer. That night, this happened. God said to him, take your father's best 7-year-old bull, the prime one, tear down your father's Baal altar and chop down the Asherah fertility pole beside it. Then build an altar to God, your God, on the top of this hill. Take the prime bull and present it as a whole burnt offering using firewood from the Asherah pole that you cut down. And Gideon selected 10 men from his servants and did exactly what God had told him. But because of his family and the people in the neighborhood, he was afraid to do it openly, so he did it that night. Early in the morning, the people in town were shocked to find Baal's altar torn down, the Asherah pole beside it chopped down, and the prime bull burning away on the altar that had been built. They kept asking, who did this? Questions and more questions, and then the answer, Gideon, son of Joash, did it. The men of town demanded of Joash, bring out your son, he must die. Why, he tore down the Baal altar and chopped down the Asherah tree. But Joash stood up to the crowd pressing in on him. Are you going to fight Baal's battles for him? Are you going to save him? Anyone who takes Baal's side will be dead by morning if Baal is a god. In fact, let him fight his own battles and defend his own altar. They nicknamed Gideon that day Jerub Baal because after he had torn down the Baal altar, he had said, let Baal fight his own battles. So the story here is that the angel of God comes to Gideon and says, go fight the Midianites. And Gideon says, what? Me, first of all, and then what? Why would I? He asked for something. What does he say? Show me a sign. I know you're saying to do this thing, but I need something tangible in front of me. I need a sign right here, right now. So he does this whole thing where he prepares the meat, prepares the flour, and then and the dough that hasn't risen yet. Then what happens? It's consumed. And when he sees that, it's clear, right? Like, oh, hey, I got it now. And so he, at night, sneaks out, cuts down the pole that was some kind of form of worship and all that, all right? So we would expect in this story then that the next time the angel comes to Gideon, what's going to happen now? He's on board, right? Let's keep reading. All the Midianites and Amalekites crossed over the river and made camp in the valley of Jezreel. God's spirit came over Gideon. He blew his ram's horn trumpet, and the Abiezrites came out ready to follow. He dispatched messengers all through Manasseh, calling them to battle, also to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. They all came. And Gideon said to God, if this is right, if you are using me to save Israel as you've said, then look, I'm placing a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If dew is on the fleece only, but the floor is dry, then I know you will use me to save Israel as you would. That's what happened. When he got up early the next morning, he wrung out the fleece, enough dew to fill a bowl of water. Then Gideon said to God, don't be impatient with me, but let me say one more thing. I want to try another time with the fleece, but this time let the fleece stay dry while the dew drenches the ground. And God made it happen that very night, only the fleece was dry while the ground was wet with dew. So here's the progression. Angel comes to Gideon and says, I'm going to use you, mighty warrior. Gideon says, oh, wait, before we do that, why don't you give me a sign? And God says, fine, I'll give you a sign. And then Gideon does his thing, and then he goes out to battle. And then what does he do? Whoa, I need more signs. So God gives him the sign. He puts the wool out, and there's so much wool in it, he wrings it out. And Gideon then says what? Like, oh, I got it now. No. How about one more sign to let me know that this is the thing I should do? Now, as a kid reading this story, and I'd love to keep reading it because I love the Gideon story. As a kid reading this story, the way I used to read Bible stories as a kid, and as a young adult, frankly, is that I would look at a story like this and say, how do I become more like Gideon? And so I've spent many nights and many times in my prayer life playing the fleece game. Anybody else? Okay, God, if you really want me to do this thing, then you have to show me something. And I've spent a lot of energy and time in my life putting fleeces out and then trying to evaluate, did God really do that or not? Or he didn't, so I should do this thing. How many of you have spent a lot of energy in that kind of thing, making deals with God, waiting for signs, hoping that it's all going to happen? And then we're playing this game. That's the way I was taught to read Gideon. But if I take eyebrows and listen to what he says about how I'm supposed to read the Hebrew scriptures, the way I engage texts like this now is I ask myself, is this how I ought to be relating to God? Not Gideon did it and therefore I should too, but rather Gideon did it, where the way he says it, where am I in this story? Is this the right way? Is this the way I ought to be relating to God? Or do I make an ethical judgment and say, God used Gideon despite Gideon's lack of faith, despite that? Or maybe God worked with Gideon here, but is this the way I ought to be? And here's what I want to say, and then we're going to get to a lyric here. I promise we're coming to a lyric, all right? I think after 16-ish years in ministry, I think, something like that, what I've learned is that oftentimes early in our spiritual journey, we get all kinds of fleeces and signs. And frankly, we need those things. That if I asked you all to share your journey with us, tell me about as you first came to faith, as you first woke up, as you were first born again, if you come from that tradition, like as you first started your journey of faith, tell me what it was like. And many of you would have stories about fleeces and signs. Boy, I came to faith, and then this thing happened, and then that thing happened, and then this, and it was all super confirming. Like, my life got flipped, turned upside down. It was amazing. But what I also know, the wisdom I think I've come to in 16 years of journeying with people, is that isn't permanent condition. That posture of Gideon that says, hey, I need signs, I need wonders, is the posture of youth. It's the posture of a beginning stage journey. Because eventually we come to know what we know in a lot harder ways. We come to know what we know, not through fleeces and signs, but through, I put a bunch of words up here, but through discernment, about conviction, about a sense of call, this is who I am to be in the world, Some of you like to call this like inner truth. There's just a truth that's true inside of us. I know when I teach the Enneagram, particularly to the threes and the sixes and the nines, I talk a lot about finding your inner truth and living out of your inner truth, and it's hard for some of us to do that. Or maybe it just comes out of my own character. Like I follow, my faith journey is not so much about putting out fleeces and offering things to be burned up and give me a sign so I know what to do, but rather a more mature journey, one I've been on for a while, becomes a lot, in some ways harder, right? It's harder to know. And sometimes we get still fleeces-ish and signs-ish, but often it's the much harder work of discerning what's true of us and how God is inviting us to be in the world. I think there's a lot to this about the beginning of a journey and a journey that goes on longer and longer. There's a shift. And one of the things I know that I just had a meeting this week, and we were talking about spiritual direction. And we're going to talk more, you're going to hear us talk more about that in the coming months. And one of the things we talked about is that especially in a church like ours, where many of you have been on the journey for a long time, the place of spiritual direction is helping us discern and get to our inner truth and help us understand what the Spirit is doing inside of us, because the world isn't a Gideon world for us. Our faith is not Gideon kind of faith. We don't really know what happened to Gideon. The only thing the text tells us, if you go over a couple chapters, is it says Gideon had 70 kids because he had lots of wives. Oh, wait, the message says Gideon had 70 kids because he had lots of wives. I think it said he has sired all of them or something like. Anyway, so all of this is to set up the, I want to talk about a lyric. And the lyric this morning is not necessarily about one lyric, but it's about growth and progression and what happens in the span of 15 years and how you think about things differently. So if you were in my youth group in the early 2000s and you would have walked in on a Wednesday night, my youth group had a couple parts. On Sunday mornings, I did Sunday school every week and taught Sunday school. And then on Sunday nights, usually we did it small groups. And then Wednesday nights was our outreach night. And so we would have anywhere, I don't even remember how many kids we had at outreaches. 100 kids, sometimes more. And so back then, in the early 2000s, I was introduced to the band Jimmy Eat World by my good friend Dave Crow, who was a punk kid. And so we had a funny youth group where we had like jock, cheerleader, basketball player types, and then we had our punk crowd. And so The Middle came out in 2001. Y'all remember this song? You can turn it up a bit. What's happening? I don't care so much for this song because everybody knows this song, but I'm going to need lyrics for the next two. All right. So this is Jimmy Eat World. The lead singer is Jim Adkins, the guy that looks like Jim Carrey over on the left. And then in the back, the reason I got connected to Jimmy Eat World, so Dave Crow was the one who introduced me to Jimmy Eat World. And then I was at a Rob Bell conference in Grand Rapids, Michigan, called Poets, Prophets, and Preachers. Thank you. I've said this wrong for years. I like to call it Poets, Prophets, and Kings, but that has nothing to do with the conference. It was about preaching. And that's the word I always forget. And at that conference, Zach was interviewed by Rob Bell on stage. So Zach is a very outspoken Christian. And actually, we passed him on the street because I was with Dave, and Dave had a weak in the knees moment. Like, that's Zach Lind. But too shy to say hi to him. So we didn't actually meet him. We just walked by him. Anyway, so that was my introduction to Jimmy World. I've been listening to Jimmy World for like 15 years. And actually, a couple years ago, got to take Caleb to a show in Bloomington where they were redoing their album Futures. And I've always wanted bands to do this, like play an album in the order that the album is. I like the songs that way because that's the way I've always heard them. Stop mixing them around in your concert. So they played their Futures album on their 10-year anniversary top to bottom. Like, it was awesome. May have sang a lot, may have cried a little. Total taps into all my teen angst. And so Jimmy Eat World came up as an emo band. You remember emo? Dashboard Confessional, anybody? Remember that era? Yes. And so Jimmy Eat World kind of came out of that world, and then they sit in the pop punk category of music. So I found a Spotify station just like right before Christmas called Power Pop Punk. Oh, it's so good. It's so full of this kind of music, which I adore. So anyway, so they burst onto the scene. This song, The Middle, was probably the song that you all heard the most. Clarity came out before this album, but this album, the Bleed American album, came out in 2001. Interestingly, this album came out, I think, in the summertime, and then 9/11 happened, and they changed the name of the album. So the album, because they thought the idea of Bleed American after 9/11 was really ugly, and so they changed the album title, and it just became the self-named album. It became known as the Jimmy Eat World album. So the lyric in this song that you all know is this one right here. It just takes some time. Little girl, you're in the middle of the ride. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be all right. So I got to tell you where the idea for this message came from, because usually, you know, ideas comes from like Christian sources. The idea for this whole message came from pitchfork.com. Now, I don't know if you know pitchfork.com. It's a site that like rates albums and such. And so I was reading, so this year, 2015, Jimmy Eat World released their, seventh, eighth album, something like that. They release this album every couple years. And many people have said that this is the best, this year's album, the one that just released in October, is the best album that they've released since Bleed American. And it's great. Probably, if I would have said my favorite album of this year, it's probably the family favorite after Hamilton mixtape. Jimmy Eat World would be the third family if we were doing a family voting system for favorite albums of the year. So I was reading this review back in November, and I was reading it, and there was a line from the review about the difference between Jimmy Eat World a la 2001, Everything's Just Gonna Be All Right, to one of their new songs. And the reviewer made this comment and said, it's like Jimmy Eat World, it's like they grew up. In 15 years, they had this to say about your life, just hang on, you're gonna get through it, everything's gonna be all right, everything's just gonna be fine, just hang on. And there's a wisdom in that. I think at the time they were in their mid-20s, late-20s. There's a wisdom in that in some spaces in life, right? There's a wisdom to just hang on, things will get better. Like I say all the time, especially in our church, many of you are in a stage of life where you have small children. And it's like I have conversations with some of you often, many of you often, about, boy, marriage is just hard right now. I feel like it's hard for us to connect. Or I hear people say like, boy, I used to get up every morning and I used to have this sweet space of quiet and prayer and that kind of thing. And it's hard now because my kid gets up at 3:37 a.m. every day. And I want to stay connected to my spouse, and people talk about date night, but date night like tripled in cost when I have to pay for a sit or two, and it got really hard to do. And then I feel like, Jennifer and I, like a lot of our conversations like are about kids. And when do we get to talk about us? We're way more interesting than our kids, but we're always dealing with problems. More kids, more problems. And all those things. And one of the things I've been saying a lot, and I you'll hear me say it if you talk to me about these kinds of things, is it gets better. I promise you it gets better. Just hang on. Everything's going to be all right. If you can just hang on for these couple years, I'll tell you, there comes an age, your kids are going to get to an age where you can leave them at home and go out. And for some of you, that feels like a million miles away right now. But hang on, it'll get better. Some of you are in a career or a job right now that you just got to hang on. This is the beginning. It gets better. I know a guy who's an accountant, and I was talking to him once about his thing, and he's like, it's really hard right now, but when I make partner, it gets better. I just have to hang on. Everything's going to be all right. It's just a hard season now. And sometimes in the middle of life, there's just seasons and times where you can't do anything about it, and you just have to hang on and hold on to the hope that everything's going to be all right when I get there. But there's another wisdom too. So 15 years later, after The Middle, Jimmy Eat World released their new album this fall, and there's a song on there called You're Free. So I'm going to play the first verse and chorus and let you listen, and I'm going to throw the lyrics up to the first verse and chorus as they play it here. So plain, amazing the effort we put in. York pointed out. He actually looked at this line specifically. If the middle's message is hang on, everything's just going to be all right, 15 years later, adult grown-up men who all have children, I think, say, amazing the emotional bridges, tunnels, roads, and ways we go around what's one step in our face. That what maturity says is sometimes there's a season of life where you just hang on and you white knuckle it because things are going to get better. But maturity says, nope, sometimes we do a lot of work. I love that line, emotional bridges, tunnels, roads, and ways. We do everything we can to go around what's, I'm just quoting the song, what's one step in our, like what's right in front of us. That what grown-up Jimmy Eat World is talking about is like sometimes you don't just hang on, sometimes you have to fight the battles. That the phrase I like to use a lot is the only way up is through. The only way to grow is to face the thing that's in front of you and to deal with it. Like there's times, I know that in marriage sometimes, there's times where we just need to like hang on. It's a bad day. It's Tuesday, right? And we just have to get through the day and we just need to say goodnight and tomorrow's a new day. But wisdom says that sometimes that's not the thing though. The part of the maturity of growing up is saying, well, wait, this is a thing that I can't just bury. This thing I have to lean into. This thing I have to face it and I have to do it. And that's the lyric here is he says, I wish there was a way to learn it all and have everything without the cost attached. There's always a cost to growth. It requires us to dig in and to learn. One other lyric, and then I want to pull this all together. It's off the very last song on the album called Paul Roger. The song is, I believe it's a champagne called Paul Roger. Anyone? Sure, just, that's true then. there's a champagne, go ahead and start playing the song. I just want to get to a lyric about halfway into the first verse. I'm going to put it up there. The song, if you're a Jimmy Eat World fan, is a nod to a song that they wrote way back when. I think off of, was it Bleed American 23? Was on Bleed American or was it on Futures? I think it was on Futures. And it's about being 23 and full of life and all of those things. And this song, he starts talking about, he's celebrating, I believe, his birthday on a beach all alone. And then he's at a hotel by himself. And he's talking about like how it's okay. I'm okay. The song is kind of written like the relationship's over and I'm okay being there. And so there's this line in the middle of it. That line, the first time I was listening to this album going through, he talks about being alone. And this line, alone but not lonely, for those of us that are extroverts, like that line is huge. Like it's okay to be in this thing where I'm facing my stuff and I'm dealing with my stuff and I don't need to be in the party all the time. I don't need to be out there. That's not, again, it's grown up Jimmy Eat World, right? It's the voice of maturity. Like I've grown and I've understood that I can be alone and not lonely. And then this is the, I'll just let you hear the chorus. This is the family favorite, by the way. We had a good sing-along coming back from St. Louis a couple weeks ago. We listened to it a couple times. It's really super melodic. Hotel and the relationship's over and he's learning to be okay with that. Like why spend more time on this lie of a relationship if it's just gonna go on that way? Like there's a maturity to that. Like you don't just hang on, you let it go when it needs to be let go. And so the thing I've been thinking about a lot with this song, so what happened with this song is I wrote this blog post back in November and I'm like about these two songs and the juxtaposition and I even used it, for those of you that took my Enneagram class this fall, the Sunday school class, I even talked about it in there when we were talking about sevens and facing things and not avoiding and not running away and dealing with pain. So we used that as an illustration of that type. And so then I never published it. It's been sitting in my folder for a long time. And I was like, when I was like, oh, we're going to do this series. I was like, oh, I've already got all this there. And so I was pulling it out this week and then thinking through this idea up here, that the only way up is through. that the only way to grow is to go through the things that we have to face in our life. That's what adulting is. And so to pull these ideas together, here's what I want to ask this morning. It's a couple questions as we start off the new year. Maybe a fun reflection for us is, what do I know better now? I would, you know, it's funny because when a musician does an album, like, you get to hear the progression of 20-year-olds singing punk rock tunes about all the girls that they're sad about, and then adult men singing songs about what life is really like. And you get to see a progression, and you get to see Jimmy Eat World grow up. The Bible story of Gideon, we get a picture of Gideon as a young man. And I want to believe that as an older man, if an angel would have come to him at 40, 45, 50-year-old man, that he wouldn't have had the same thing, right? That I would hope that Gideon grew up at some point. And besides siring 70 children, that if God would have come to him and said, "Hey, I need you to do something, mighty warrior," Gideon would have said, "You know what? I can trust that voice, because I've trusted that voice before and I can trust it again." And so there's something that Gideon knew better maybe in his life later. There's something Jimmy Eat World knows better now at 40-something than they did in their 20s. And I know for all of us in this room, like, I was making a list, then it was just kind of embarrassing about, here's the things I used to believe about how life worked in my 20s. Here's what I know in my 40s. Can I tell one short one? I remember my pastor once, I was a year out of seminary, or 2 years out of seminary, and we were talking about how people grow and develop. And my pastor, and he had been in the ministry probably 20 years at that point, 25 years, he had his D-min in pastoral counseling. And he said once, most people don't change that much. They are who they are. And I was 24, and I just remember when he said that, I got so mad. I remember, like, arguing with him. Like, if, this is what I said, this is the embarrassing part. I said to him, "If that's what you think about people, why are you even in the ministry?" I was a punk, all right? Like, I was not somebody you'd want to work for you in my 20s. Because it just seemed so, like, fatalistic. Like, why are you, if that's what you believe about people, then why are you, like, we're in this business because we believe people can change. And I would love to go sit down with, he was probably in his late 40s at the time. I would love to sit down with late 40s Dr. Bob at my 42, almost 43, and say, "You know what? That's true. That's true of many of us. We change a little bit, but a lot of who we are who we are." And so there's things I know about life, and there's presumptions I have about, I know better now. I thought things were like this, but they're really like this. I thought faith was like this. I thought faith was signs and wonders and fleeces, but I've learned it's not. And so maybe another question is, how does faith look differently for you? How has your faith journey grown? What does it mean to be faithful? And some of us have a longing and an ache for the days when it was all about the signs and the miracles and the fleeces. But today it's different, and we need to keep progressing in that journey. And then maybe one last question this morning is, what's one step from your face, to take the line from the song? What's that thing that you're avoiding that you just keep thinking, if I just hold on, it's all going to get better? And maybe not. Maybe it's the thing that you're supposed to lean into, the thing you're supposed to go through so that you can grow up, so that you can move on to the next thing in your life. We're going to finish with a song or two. We're going to sing two songs. If you have kids in the nursery, during the second one, will you relieve the nursery people, please? I'm going to pray, and they're going to get in place. God, help us to find ourselves in the stories, to find where we fit in those stories, to find, I think especially with those of us who have kids that are reading, and as we're talking about the Bible stories, and how do they fit, and help us to get the bird's eye view and think through what Jesus taught and assess. And God, many of us have incredible fleece-like stories and sign-type stories of what you did back there. And a part of us laments and hurts for those moments. So, like, we wish we had that kind of clarity, because faith is a harder thing now, but help us to keep growing up. to keep becoming something, to keep moving from a childhood type faith to more adult faith, and help us to keep pushing into that journey. And God, to embrace hard things, to embrace hard conversations or hard ideas or hard investigations of ourselves and the way we are in the world, and help us in all of that to find what you have for us. In your name I pray, amen.